Okay, welcome back to the second hour of Transmissions from a Dying Planet. And we welcome our guest from the great state of Texas, Nick Redfern.
Hey, Evan, how's it going?
Very good, very good. For those of you who don't know Mr. Redfern, he is the author of how many books, Nick?
I think up to about 18, something like that.
Starting to lose track, aren't you?
Yeah.
I would describe you, see if you like this description, as this generation's Brad Steiger.
Oh, well, thank you. I would take that as a compliment. I think Brad's, you know, I know Brad as a friend, and he covers a lot of areas, and I think, you know, Brad isn't afraid to ask awkward questions and go with alternative theories, which, you know, I feel when we're dealing with phenomena that's definitively anomalous, then, you know, we shouldn't get sort of sidetracked into or pigeonholed in belief systems, et cetera. We should just, you know, look at whatever the data is and record it and present it to people. So
sometimes that ruffles a few feathers, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it does, but my answer is, well, so what? Doesn't hurt to ruffle feathers.
And also you do your own hair, right?
Yeah, I do. I'm my own personal hairstylist. Every morning I get the shaving cream and the razor out, and if I go out at night, it gets a second going over. So.
Yeah. So the topic at hand is your latest book, Final Events, which you've been working on for a number of years. You mentioned this back to me in 2007. I thought, well, that's an intriguing book, and here 3 years or so later, it's come into being. Why don't you talk about how this whole thing evolved and your principal source, Ray Boucher, is that his name?
Boucher. Yeah. Well, basically, the book itself, for people who haven't seen it, is in simple terms and condensed terms, it's basically a study of a think tank type group within the U.S. government's military and intelligence community that looked at the UFO issue for a number of years, concluded it was very real, but rather than deciding that it was extraterrestrial or, you know, I don't know, interdimensional or time travelers or crypto-terrestrials, as some people have suggested, they actually came to the conclusion that it was quite literally, and I do mean literally, demonic in origin. It was sort of like a demonic deception. And that's the sort of thrust of the story. But what happened was that in 2007, I interviewed a man named Ray Boucher. And Ray is a priest based in Lincoln, Nebraska. But for a number of years, Ray actually was the state director for Nebraska for the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON. And, you know, it isn't sort of very often you see someone who's a practicing priest also, you know, not just investigating UFOs, but acting as a, you know, a state head for MUFON. And he was involved in a number of well-known investigations, for example, the famous Rendlesham Forest UFO landing of 1980 in England. Ray lobbied his senator to try and see if there were additional files and material in the U.S. that might be available through the Freedom of Information Act, etc. So he did a lot of sort of very proactive, good research. And in 1991, Ray was approached by two physicists, who described themselves as being attached to a Department of Defense/Pentagon project, which was, the way it sounds, was kind of like an offshoot of the whole remote viewing project of a few years earlier. The idea was that they looked deeply into the UFO issue and concluded that these entities, the Greys, whatever they were, seemed to possess extraordinary mind powers, and that while it wasn't necessarily possible to physically interact with them, you know, that would just be more at random, they felt that entering into altered states and the power of the mind might actually allow us to contact and interact with them in that way. And being the military, the idea was, well, if these entities are real, they seem to possess extraordinary mind powers, so can we sort of understand and exploit them and then use it as a weapon? You know, typical military thinking. The idea was, in simple terms, you know, can we harness these powers and, I guess, you know, do things like remotely induce heart attacks and strokes, almost like a psychic assassination. And Ray actually told me that The meeting with these two guys, the first two meetings, occurred at a hotel in Lincoln, Nebraska, where they met for lunch, and there were various follow-up meets and exchanges and phone calls, etc. And the story was that this was sort of very, you know, very deeply buried project. They never referred to these entities as aliens. They described them as NHEs, which allegedly stood for non-human entities. And so that the plan was to sort of enter in, I guess, into like a Faustian pact almost with these beings, which a lot of the people in the project supposedly did believe were aliens to start with. Then, as time went on, it seemed as if like a negative black air or atmosphere descended upon the project. People were killed in certain experiments. Ray told me he was shown various photographs of literally people dead, sat in what looked like dentist chairs, how he described it, who had been killed, you know, in these experiments. And it was almost like, you know, they would enter the room and it was kind of like entering a haunted house. There was just sort of this sickening atmosphere hanging over everything. And these guys, granted, one of the most important things is that they were quite sort of rigid in their belief systems, Christians, and they came to interpret this as not literal extraterrestrials, but demonic entities trying to deceive us with an extraterrestrial motif, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray speculated, and he admitted it was speculation, but he felt that the reason why possibly they contacted him more than any other person in the UFO community was because he had a background in ufology, but he was also well-versed in things like demonology and religion, and he felt they wanted his advice as to how and even if they should get this story out into the public domain. Now, Ray himself didn't, although he mentioned it in a couple of lectures, he actually mentioned it in a lecture in Gulf Breeze in 94, and his story was briefly mentioned in literally like a page or so in one of Jenny Randall's books about 12 years ago, and also in Linda Howe's, one of Linda Howe's books in the early to mid-1990s. I think it was Glimpses of Other Realities. But other than that, he never really told the story. But I happened to come across the story in both Linda Howe's and Jenny Randall's books and kept thinking, you know, over time, wow, it'd be interesting to follow up on this, and then forgetting about it. And then eventually I was going through one of the books for something else when I was writing something on Rendlesham, came across Ray's story again and thought, well, you know, let's see if I can track him down. And somebody in the UFO community gave me what they thought was his current contact details, and they were. I phoned him up and he said, yeah, I'll be happy to tell you the entire story of how and why this group got together, the research and the sort of mind power investigations they did, and how they came to believe there was this sort of ufological deception going on. And that's really what sort of kicked me off on the quest that took me then further, if you like.
Yeah, I'm curious, the whole thing with using these mind powers and stopping people's hearts or whatever they were doing, how does this connect to the aliens? I'm trying to sort this out. Were they channeling these powers?
Well, that was basically the theory. The notion was that these entities, the group came to believe that these entities seemed to inhabit not like a nuts and bolts, knock on the side of the UFO type environment, and that they may not even have been purely physical in the way we understand it. The group came to believe that this may have been something almost like an hallucination, whereas these entities were literally almost like a, I won't say spirit form, because that sort of goes down like, you know, more of a religious path anyway, but more like non-physical beings, but that seemed to project outward reality, but it was sort of like, or more like a mirage, or that they possibly inhabited some other realm that possibly would be more explainable by things like quantum physics, like another dimension, but one that we couldn't access physically, so we would need to use harness mind powers. And in simple terms, it literally was kind of like the theory was tuning a radio into a particular station. Could we tune our minds into their minds and understand if there are sort of latent powers buried deep in our minds, and could these entities kind of rewire us or, you know, tweak us and show us how to do what they can apparently do? That was literally the scenario they were working with, the idea of, you know, literally calling these up and channeling them like the channelers would, you know, decades ago. And then hopefully, you know, their mind would be filled with the information on how to do this. Now, Ray felt, and the scientists felt, that even if these experiments were successful, but it was the entities themselves that were actually doing it. He felt that they all felt that it was never actually the people who were taking part in the experiments. They thought they were doing these sort of wonderful things, but the conclusion was after a while that it was the entities pulling the strings and doing it all along. But again, to make it seem like they were benevolent and trying to help us. But again, that was just a particular theory. It literally was, you know, sort of almost like the equivalent of George Van Tassel or somebody, or Reverend Short, Bob Short, you know, channeling voices. In this case, they were trying to channel information on how to do things with their minds.
Do you think this group, this think tank, and their name is the Collins Elite, or whatever they might be, name they might be going by, are still active?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. The story I got was that they were active up until a couple of years ago, at least.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't seem to be overly active now, not in the sense that they've closed down and disbanded, but more on the lines that they quite literally feel that they've proven their point, the notion that they do believe that there's like a demonic aspect to the UFO phenomenon, and that they, bear in mind, this is one of the most important things I stress in the book, many of the group members, both prior and after joining the group, were Christians, and some of them were fundamentalist Christians, so that inevitably has a bearing on the fact that they came to believe, possibly, or interpret this as demonic rather than some people might interpret as interdimensional or extraterrestrial, but in a fashion that's so far in advance of us, it looks demonic to people who hold those views.
Sure.
Anyway, they came to the conclusion that they'd sort of solved it. And the story that I kind of was able to put together was that they feel that the current modern-day UFO motif, if you like, is sort of the last deception, the last form of deception before the final battle between good and evil and, you know, ancient prophecies about Armageddon and, you know, a battle for our souls comes to pass. But again, you know, as I stress, this is their belief system in the same way that, you know, Matt Tonis suggested crypto-terrestrials were at work, or Stan Friedman might say, you know, Roswell involved aliens. It was interpreting the evidence and then coming to a conclusion, you know, that differed from somebody else's conclusions.
Sure, yeah. Why don't you talk about, take us back in time to the late 40s and how this, how and why this group initially started.
Yeah, this is sort of like a long, well, not long, but it's sort of a convoluted story. Basically, what happened was that most of the original members actually had no particular role in, you know, in setting up some sort of think tank. What happened was that Jack Parsons, who, of course, was a sort of devotee and follower of Aleister Crowley, who'd had his own experience with sort of this large, headed entity in 1918 known as LAM, which, you know, looks kind of like the second cousin of the thing on the cover of Communion. You know, it looks pretty alien. You know, with these sort of little withered shoulders and this large head, you do get sort of this image of a dwarf-like extraterrestrial. But Crowley had this experience. Then Jack Parsons, who was certainly one of the earliest and most brilliant rocket pioneers, and his company Aerojet, even to this day, still make the solid rocket boosters for the space shuttle program. You know, he was a maverick, which nothing wrong with that. But he was also, you know, as I said, a brilliant scientist. And actually, I got hold of literally hundreds of pages of files on Parsons, official files, and which demonstrate that he had a top secret clearance with the Army, Navy, and Air Force on certain rocket-based programs. Well, what happened was that in the late 1940s, after the State of Israel came into being, Parsons, you know, having his own company, heard that, you know, Israel was looking to develop its own, you know, military arsenals to a greater degree. And he thought, well, you know, it might be nice to get a foot in the door, see if they're interested in my work. And so what he did, he actually sort of smuggled some papers out of work to demonstrate the sort of things he was working on for the Israelis. And, of course, the military and in the intelligence community and the FBI thought, well, you know, is this guy actually acting as an espionage agent for Israel, or has he just been very stupid and instead of sending out a resume, you know, decided to borrow, quote, documents from work?
Mm-hmm.
and show them to the Israelis. And there was an extensive investigation. He lost his top secret clearance, but it was concluded that he was just a maverick, you know, in the same way that he had an alternative way to his rocket programs, where he'd actually invoke the god Pan before rocket launches, that he was being reckless and alternative in his means to try and convince the Israelis that he was good to work for them, you know, by taking documents. But what happened was that many of the original people who comprised sort of the first incarnation of this group, the Collins Elite, were involved in the espionage aspects of Parsons. And so this sort of related to closely watching him, you know, doing background checks on him and his friends and colleagues. And it involved people from Air Force Intelligence, Army Intelligence, Naval Intelligence, CIA, and FBI. And what happened was that the more they dug into his military background and the work he was doing, the more they found out, as you would naturally understand because they were looking into his personal life as well, the more they found out about his, quote, other life, you know, with Parsons and L. Ron Hubbard and, you know, being involved with things like the Babylon Working, trying to conjure up elementals and different entities and things like this. And they also heard a story that, again, in sort of a convoluted way, that Parsons, on possibly one or two occasions, had met none other than Kenneth Arnold, the man who arguably ushered in the modern era of UFOs. And according to one of the people I interviewed, an elderly man named Richard Duke, he told me that the way this went was because Parsons was friends, for a while at least, with L. Ron Hubbard. Hubbard wrote sci-fi. Hubbard was well known to Ray Palmer, who was, you know, the editor, one of the founding editors of, you know, the leading world of sci-fi in the 40s. And Palmer co-wrote and published Kenneth Arnold's The Coming of the Flying Saucers. And so the story was that it was in this sort of roundabout way that possibly once and maybe twice, but that was certainly it, that Parsons and Arnold actually did meet. And these same people looking into Parsons' background found out that Parsons had a colleague, although certainly not a friend, Robert Goddard, another early rocket pioneer, who'd chosen to move to none other than Roswell to undertake his rockets research. And although the group, or the people I interviewed at least, said that although they weren't cleared back in the 40s to know what happened at Roswell, there was a lot of suspicions that the weather balloon story didn't tell the whole story. And so, as they freely admitted to me, they were putting strands together along the lines of, you know, Crowley had contacted this large-headed entity, Lamb. Parsons was a devotee and a follower of Crowley. He'd met possibly Kenneth Arnold. He had a colleague out at Roswell. You know, and they were sort of putting all this together and trying to piece the jigsaw together. Now, the big question is whether or not they did that successfully, or they were just picking strands out that seemed to fit and they, you know, hammered them into place to make them fit. That's the big question.
Mm-hmm. It seems all intertwined, this magic rituals and the space program.
Yeah.
And UFOs. And as the legend goes, Parsons using these Crowleyan rituals, or whatever you want to call it, this Babylon working, as the legend goes, opened up the same portal that Aleister Crowley did, and this was in 1946.
That's
allegedly correct. When Parsons did this, and once again, as the legend goes, Parsons didn't close this portal that he opened, which ushered in the modern era of UFOs.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is what happened right after this was that the group, as the people I interviewed at least told me, what happened was that there was no official group actually for several years. We sort of talking 1952 even before things really took off as a group. But between sort of 49, 50, 51, the people who'd sort of followed Parsons on this espionage operation, as one of the people described it to me, you know, when they were together, if they were all in town or, you know, they're working. A lot of them were actually sort of based on the West Coast, so they would cross paths now and again. You know, they would sort of meet, as one of them told me, for martinis after work in some local bar or whatever, restaurants, and discuss what was going on, you know, because they got an interest and they started following the whole UFO thing unofficially. And the story was that by about 52, just after Parsons died, when he was supposedly or possibly involved in some other invocation, that you had the whole 1952 Washington, D.C. wave, which kicked off only 4 weeks after Parsons was killed. Actually, 3 weeks after he was killed in this explosion in his lab. And it was then that the group was offered the opportunity. It was something along the lines of, well, Blue Book isn't having much luck, you know, looking at things from radar perspective and pilot perspectives. You know, they've got reports, but it's not helping solve what's going on. Why don't we channel some money into these guys, give them the, you know, offer them, like, positions where it would be sort of semi-official, where they would sort of leave their official jobs for a while and become part of this, like, a paid think tank. Now, as you said, you know, they believe this doorway was opened. They actually believe that these doorways have always been open to some degree, and they concluded that in the past everything like djinns, fairies, goblins were all early manifestations of these same demonic entities. But they basically concluded that when the doorway was opened with the UFO phenomenon in the late 40s, that this was like the ultimate door-opening act that opened the floodgates en masse, so to speak, to allow for the final countdown, if you like. And they were also looking in the early 50s at things like, for example, with the Space Brothers and the contactee movement, George Hunt Williamson, you know, everybody thinks of the contactees, they're meeting aliens out in the desert, sort of long-haired space babes, etc. It wasn't always like that. I mean, George Hunt Williamson, you know, allegedly used Ouija boards to channel these entities almost, you know, to send messages through the boards. The group concluded that was further evidence of the demonic angle, or an occult angle at least. And on top of that, Desmond Leslie, who co-wrote George Adamski's first book, Flying Saucers Have Landed, his father, Sir Shane Leslie, was a huge devotee of the occult and actually was steeped in the teachings of Aleister Crowley. So they picked up on that as well, you know, the fact that everybody and his brothers along the way somehow seemed to be mixed up with the occult, Ouija boards, Crowley, Parsons, and they're all intermingled. And so that was sort of when it really began to sort of take shape as a group, looking at all these different strands in sort of around about 52, apparently.
So somehow the genie got out of the bottle at this during this period, and whoever they weren't able to recork the bottle, which ushered in this era of the UFO knots. So it's pretty interesting. There are certain years where a lot of stuff was going on, and Kenneth Arnold had his famous sighting in 47, which kind of started the whole wave where the term of flying saucers entered the popular lexicon. Also in 47, Aleister Crowley died.
Yeah. Then
we go to 52, you mentioned Parsons died, and it seemed like another wave of these UFOs started in 1952. And you've written a book called The Contactees, and I've looked into this quite a bit. It seems if you look into the history of UFOs, that's when Adamski had his famous sighting in 52, and a wave of other UFO contactees. What do you think is going on with these dates?
Well, you know, I mean, I think, I guess, again, to an extent, we're forced to make an interpretation based on what we know. I mean, what I would say is that, you know, you have a lot of people within ufology today who still sort of adhere to the whole the whole Kehoe angle of, oh, it's just a military cover-up of aliens landing or crashing and, you know, hiding dead corpses and crashed UFOs in some hangar, and we're trying to get hold of the secret files, etc. To me, that's a very simplistic approach. The more I've come to it, personally, people ask me, you know, a number of people read the book and thought I'd sort of turn into some raving fundamentalist, which isn't true. You know, when I was writing the book, me and Patrick at the publisher, Patrick Weed, you know, we discussed how I should present the story. And so what I did was to actually sort of leave my views out and tell it from a historical perspective. But that still didn't stop people from thinking I was trying to endorse the theory. I felt I wanted to write it in the same way someone would write a book about the history of the FBI or the CIA. You know, you would present the story, how they were formed and what they did. So that's what I tried to do. Now, when you ask me what do I think was going on, I actually do believe, you know, getting a, this is why I mentioned the Kehoe thing. If we get away from that angle, I think there's strong evidence that the best way to interact with whatever the phenomenon might be is in an altered state. I think that's far more successful than chasing it with aircraft, tracking it on radar, or going out at night with a bunch of binoculars and night scope equipment or whatever. I think there's strong evidence that this is a phenomenon that acts unlike anything we would expect. It's not the equivalent of Apollo astronauts coming to the Earth. It's something far stranger, and they seem to exist in a totally different form of reality to us. And so for that reason, I think more than anything else, that explains why there was so much going on in that period to do with altered states in terms of contact. Now, in terms of the years, now that, you know, you can go down some weird paths. You know, when you look at, for example, as you said, Crowley dying in 47, then you got things like the Dead Sea Scrolls being found, the State of Israel being set up, all sorts of things. And, of course, you know, these people with their sort of Christian perspective did take the view that this was sort of all connected with prophecies, etc. So,
I think there's something going on there with those dates. Another thing I've noticed, a lot of these experiences seem to happen around the dog days of August, the dog days of Sirius, from late July into early August. Just look for that. Something
that's
else.
You got Roswell, I guess. Kenneth Arnold. Yeah.
Just a lot of the accounts, even in your own books on the contactees. A lot of those sightings seem to happen in late July, early August. At this point, Nick, why don't you tell folks where to find this book, Final Events, and all your other stuff?
All right. Well, it's called Final Events, and it's published by Anomalous Books, and it's available Barnes & Noble, Borders, Amazon, all good book-selling outlets, and probably a few bad ones as well. So.
And do you have a website?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
Where to?
Yeah, nickredfern.com is my website, and at the website I have a lot of blogs on different subjects. I have a Final Events blog which sort of updates all the latest news and things. So people go to the website, they can contact me and learn more about the books. And if they click on the blog section, they can find all the different stuff I'm doing in various subjects.
Well, this book has got a lot of interest recently. I think I contacted you like about a month and a half to be interviewed and thought I was going to get one of the first interviewed. Interviews on this. You probably have been interviewed 20 times on the book by now.
Yeah, I've done a few, and the response from the radio shows has been quite positive. The response from the UFO community has been actually quite interesting. It's sort of been sort of three different things.
Mm-hmm.
One, you know, you have the people who think, what on earth has happened to Nick Redfern? Is he running around, you know, trying to warn everybody that the end's coming and demons are going to land, etc.? No, I'm not. You know, as I said, this isn't my story. And I point out at the beginning of the book, I'm relating what I was told. And this is like a history of how the group came to exist, why it exists, and the circumstances under which they came to their conclusions. So that was one thing I had to sort of put right. You know, it's not me sort of seeing the light, whatever the light may be. The other thing is that some people reacted quite vehemently to the idea that we could be dealing with anything other than aliens. And rather ironically, these people argued, well, this group just believe it's demons, but it's aliens, not realizing that their belief in the aliens is a belief system in itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we know there's a phenomenon, but we're almost forced, consciously or subconsciously, to try and work out what's going on. And inevitably, that leads to belief systems coming into place. And there have been other people who have actually been quite disturbed by it. That's actually a word I've heard mentioned several times by people contacting me, where most of my books they think it's interesting, you know, or we agree with it or we don't, but it's an interesting theory, and, wow, we didn't know about those documents. But this one, it's been, people have said it's disturbing, it's unsettling, it made them feel quite weird in a way, in ways they couldn't really understand, you know, almost like an unsettling feeling, which, you know, I guess on the one hand, I've done the job right then if, you know, telling a creepy story. But on the other hand, you know, it shows that the phenomenon, is actually, regardless of its origins, is sort of weirder than, you know, the stuff that was put out 40, 50 years ago by the likes of Kehoe and Stringfield, etc.
Well, I wouldn't think this theory would be too popular with the disclosure crowd.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I mean, you see, this is the thing. I mean, when you have people like Disclosure, anybody who's behind Disclosure is basically saying, we want you to tell us the truth about alien UFOs. That, you know, it isn't, we want disclosure of what's going on with time travelers from the future, or we want you to tell us the truth about how Mac Tonis got it right with his crypto-terrestrials theory. It's almost that Disclosure is assumed to involve aliens from other worlds in other solar systems. And so, again, this is the big problem. You know, if people want to push for Disclosure, that's fine, but have an open mind on what Disclosure might be.
They might not want Disclosure.
Well, no,
that's
right. And I mean, you know, I do actually agree with this group, the Collins Elite, is that although, you know, I freely admit I'm not a particularly religious person, but where I do absolutely agree with them is that this phenomenon seems to be deceptive, and it also seems to have the ability, I believe, to alter the way in which it manifests throughout the years to suit the perceptions and beliefs of the people of the time. You know, I do really believe that, and they did. You know, they believed, as I said, that djinns, goblins, everything else. They don't believe, as some people do in the UFO research community, that people 500 years ago were misinterpreting real sightings of aliens or djinns or whatever as djinns and goblins. They actually believe that these creatures manifested back then the way the people of that time would have expected them to appear. And then in the 50s, they appeared as long-haired, benevolent aliens. And then in the 70s and 80s, it was sort of the cold, clinical greys, etc.
Right. Or the late 1800s, you had all the reports of airships.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think Viz has a question or two. Viz?
Yeah, if I could, Nick. Going back to the Right Reverend Boucher.
Yeah.
I guess you can call me a fundamentalist Christian or a whole lot of other things, but I was kind of interested in the way that he approached it, because I could understand why he felt that might make some kind of rumbling in a Christian fundamentalist or even non-fundamentalist community. However, because I was at a point at one time where if you had said this to me, it's like, get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that way now. Did he take you through the time, I mean, where he might have been more comfortable with what he, quote, knew, and or has this cost him at all?
No, I don't think it's affected him adversely at all. Rather ironically, I think what happened was that Ray, you know, discussed his story at a lecture. He told Jenny Randles about it because she mentioned it in one of her books, and certainly shared it with Linda Howe. But it seems to be the case that the UFO community, being what it is and being so dominated by the whole ET angle, actually just didn't do much with the story. And, you know, so he wasn't affected to any great extent because this meeting occurred in 91. And he mentioned it in 94 in Linda's book and 98 in Jenny Randall's book. But really, other than that, the story kind of went under the radar. And so, you know, Ray hasn't sort of been badly affected by it because, you know, ufology was too busy running around chasing the MJ-12 documents and things like that. And that, I think, is one of the big problems, is that much of today's ufology has just been so polarized into trying to prove that ET has visited and crashed and burned, you know. And, you know, I mean, I know people in the UFO community sort of frown upon the idea that we could, you know, the whole Rick Strassman thing of contacting otherworldly entities through DMT, etc. So, in other words, you know, Ray didn't basically come in for any criticism or suffer adversely, because no one was really taken that much notice, unfortunately, which to my view was a mistake, you know, regardless of what the answers are.
It seems that the Christian notion is that anything connected with ETs or UFOs, mm-hmm. you know, is necessarily demonic. Now, I was kidding somewhat in the first hour with Adam that, well, if they were good guys, why haven't they come around earlier? But I'll say this. I don't know that they're expressly demonic, but I have no problem believing that, you know, that there's a lot of things going on above us and from below. Did Reverend Boucher at any time find, a happy medium, if there's without necessarily compromising his views, about exactly where that might fit in Scripture?
Well, you know, it's interesting that actually nobody really sort of pointed out the fact that we seem to have good and bad. It seemed to be all bad, and but that when the final countdown came, you know, the positive side would show itself. And that then, you know, it would be a case of literally the final confrontation between good and evil and, you know, the ancient prophecies coming to fruition. But it seemed to be the case that it was almost like the temptation and deception. I mean, it was just that one side of it. It wasn't the other side as well. It was almost that was staying in the background, biding its time until, you know, the day or whatever arrives.
How did you come down on this yourself? Do you feel that whatever's out there, under whatever, is going to show itself at a certain time, and that we'll find out exactly what's going on? I mean, and this might come in with a tribulation type of scenario.
Yeah. Well, I mean, certainly that's what a lot of people believe and what a lot of people say. You know, my only doubt about that is that, you know, regardless of what's at the heart of the UFO phenomenon, we've heard many times, oh, the truth's coming next year, or the government's going to come clean, or this is going to happen. You know, and prophecies, we've had a lot of prophecies throughout the end of the world prophecies and things like this. You know, Nostradamus 1999, next one's 2012. So, in other words, I don't discount the possibilities, but I think when you look at the fact that so many prophecies and showings that are going to happen never occur, I think we have to sort of balance the probability or lack of probability against what's come previously. Now, that doesn't mean there isn't some ultimate prophecy. It just means that, you know, we're almost in like the boy who cried wolf situation. You know, do we end up just looking away when the real one arrives because there have been so many fake ones? You know, it's difficult to say, really, I guess.
Well, and I don't think any of us know, and we shouldn't even purport to say that we do. And again, I had been talking to Adam earlier, you know, about the nature of things. But it seems to me, separate from even a spiritual outlook, that in my life, I've had some experiences. I even remember my folks having them. I mean, not often, but this thing about ETs, UFOs, whatever, seems to plop itself in you know, basically average people's lives. And we deal with this, and it's the one thing I find fascinating, that we know something's going on. Most of us will trust, you know, either our own experiences or other anecdotes of those who we do trust, and say, look, something's going on, and they're not being clean with us. Is it stuff that we're making, or humans, I should say, not necessarily just Americans, or is it something from without or from below, or is it a combination of everything? My feeling was that it was kept muddied just to catch everybody in that quagmire so they don't know, and yet they're not being given plausible denial. Nick, can I ask you, from all that you've seen, where are we with that whole scenario? I mean, do you find that deliberately we've not been told what's going on?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think the important thing to remember is that, you know, when people say they want the government to tell the truth, you know, the government isn't really like a unified entity. It sort of appears like that, but it's made up of different tiers and groups and agencies, and different people have sway and influence here and there. And I think that certainly comes into play with UFOs. I think that, you know, whether or not there is a centralized group that knows everything and is hiding it from us, or different people have different strands, and possibly, you know, they have a lot of information and data, and maybe, you know, they even have some sort of hard evidence, wreckage or biological whatever, you know, who knows. But just because they have material evidence or in a lot of documentation doesn't necessarily mean they have the answers.
Right.
And so when people are pushing for disclosure, I actually think it could be quite ironic that what the government is hiding is its ignorance of the fact that it knows something's going on, but it has no idea what, rather than sitting on this huge secret that it knows all about. You know, I think that may be part of the reluctance to come clean, is purely because after 60 years, they might have more information than the average UFO researcher, but, you know, they're still scratching their heads. It'd be kind of ironic if we're having this conversation on the phone now, and there's two Pentagon generals saying, I wonder what really happened at Roswell. You know, we've got the wreckage, but who are they? You know what I mean?
Sure.
And I actually think that could something along those lines could be true, that it's a baffling phenomenon that they know exists, but they're kind of looking at it from a military intelligence mindset, where maybe they should be looking at it from almost like an alternative, you know, viewpoint. You know, the idea of dimensional physics and altered states of mind. And maybe certain groups have looked at it from that perspective and realized that there is something to that, but even they don't understand the full complexities of it. I think it's something far... If it was just nuts and bolts aliens, maybe we would have been told. I think somewhere the penny's dropped, so to speak, mm-hmm. and they realize that whatever it is, it's far too weird to tell because... I don't really know what it is they're telling. So.
Adam, if you could give me just two more questions and I'll get out of the way.
Oh, certainly.
I'm going to ask them in the reverse order of what I had wanted to, but since you mentioned the Pentagon, I've had a guest on who I feel is very credible, saying that there's been some who has done work in and around the DOD and in the Washington area, and has said that the DOD has had some very interesting visitors come in. in quotation marks, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
If that is to be believed as true, mm-hmm. The intimation at least, can we actually believe that the government doesn't know more than they're saying? And I know you said that, but would the DOD, if we can agree, that have had some kind of reasonable, in-depth, whatever that means, dealings with whatever, might they know more or...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they know a massive amount of more, or they know a lot more than we know. And I'm sure there are probably thousands of pages of documents, you know, that we've never even seen and possibly never even will see. But that doesn't necessarily answer the question. Even if you have a body, let's just say weird bodies were found at Roswell, as the Collins elite actually concluded. If you say, you know, weird bodies were found at Roswell and wreckage was found, let's say these entities may have manifested and appeared, etc., but what if we've had no real direct interaction with them? What it means is we have stored away, you know, maybe a couple of tons of weird material and four bodies in the equivalent of freezers, and that's all we have, and that tells us nothing beyond the fact that something weird has visited us. I think it's along those lines. They may have hard evidence. They may have strong evidence and massive amounts of data, but that doesn't answer any questions about the origin or intent of the phenomenon. And I think it's the origin and the intent that is the important thing that they don't have the answers to. So that's why they're not coming clean, so to speak.
Would you agree that that's probably why they leave it? And they know that the population by this time... has some kind of understanding and is probably going to be willing to accept it, but do you believe that's why they leave it just out there as a question mark? Because it just seems probably they can catch everybody in that level.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a subtle thing. You know, on the one hand, you sort of subtly tell people or may imply that the government knows all about aliens visiting the Earth, but then you subtly also see memes, if you like, that the government's hiding it. What that actually does is provide a scenario where everybody, whether they believe it or not, knows the theories about the government's hiding stuff on aliens. And maybe that's what they want us to think. Maybe they're actually hiding something about a phenomenon they don't really understand. But I think they're comfortable, ironically, in having us think they know it's extraterrestrial and they're in charge and on top of everything and it's all for our own good.
Right, and we can identify them as saying, okay, you're keeping something from us, and we can actually live with that.
Yes, yeah.
All right, last question. I had done an interview many, many years ago Let me just ask you this in case this name should have popped up. Are you familiar with the name Eric Lee Jewell?
No, I'm not. No.
Okay, fine. I had him on, a Christian, I'd say credible, and share with me, I think more off mic than on, because of the nature of what he was going to say, that he did believe in UFOs, etc., and that he had been abducted along with his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And this is out in the wilderness in Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
And had also said to me that he thought, or at least he said he knew, that whatever is out there is both good and bad.
Mm.
Now, having said that, and looking toward the experiences and the information that Reverend Boucher had, abduction seems to push a lot of people outside the envelope. Can you tell me how he reacted to it, and also the whole idea of abductions in general?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like with the disclosure thing. Abductions, at first glance, it's sort of a very simplistic angle of your people are being taken by, quote, extraterrestrial scientists who are milking us for our DNA, etc., because their species is on an evolutionary decline, and, you know, they need to beef it up with the involvement and inclusion of new blood, if you like, and quite literally, you know, ours. And that makes sense, or I guess that appeals to our sensibilities and common sense, because it would possibly be the sort of thing we would do. You know, we experiment on animals, and, you know, we do gene splicing now and all sorts of things. So it makes sense. But then when you look further into abductions, as Ray has done, you know, you find these other aspects where some events seem to occur in like a non-physical environment, where people have talked about, you know, they felt sort of like bodily soul separation. There are a number of stories like that of people feeling, you know, that they actually saw themselves in the UFO. Like somebody reports a near-death experience in a hospital. There are other cases where if you can read pretty much any abduction book, particularly people like David Jacobs and also the late John Mack, where they interviewed people who'd said, you know, that some of these entities seemed to be more interested in the human soul. They got a feeling that these entities were sort of voracious for the human soul in some fashion. Now, for example, Nigel Kerner, an English author, has written a number of books, like Song of the Greys, and he has also sort of concluded that these entities seem to be overly fascinated and intrigued by the human soul, not from a religious perspective, but literally because they don't have souls and they're trying to genetically combine themselves with us to create like an everlasting life for them as well. So it goes far beyond the normal notion of, for many researchers, the normal notion of just aliens coming to Earth. And Ray, you know, Ray has sort of expressed these ideas as well, that, you know, the phenomenon itself is more of a religious nature than it is anything to do with these scientists. And a number of the people, again, I interviewed for the book, suggested that the whole alien abduction scenario was almost like a charade to seed like a meme throughout society, that everybody would know that what it's supposed to mean. And you could argue that everybody does recognize what alien abduction means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if this is true, that their ruse has actually worked, because it allows these entities to conduct whatever they're really doing under the guise of people thinking, oh, yeah, it's those aliens who need to take our DNA, etc. So.
Hey, Nick, with the whole disclosure thing and alternate theories, Walter Bosley, he's a friend of mine, and I'm sure you're familiar with him. He helps host Greg Bishop's Radio Mysterioso. Bosley claims that his father was involved in military intelligence and had a connection to Roswell.
Mm.
And I don't know if you've heard this, but
yes,
his father claimed that these beings that crashed and burned at Roswell actually came from the inner Earth.
Mm. Yeah, I've heard that. That's an interesting theory. Yeah.
And there's other folks who claim that's where the ETs or ITs, inner Earth beings, actually come from. I mean, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an interesting theory. You know, it's been sort of, it goes back from the days of Shaver, you know, mm-hmm. through Walter Bosley's dad to McTownish. You know, it's an interesting one. And, you know, I mean, we cannot rule it out. The one thing I would say that is kind of in its favor as it relates to abductions, at least, is, you know, I always kind of find it strange that aliens from how many light years away are so compatible with us.
Mm-hmm, right,
that we can combine and splice our DNA, etc. It would make more sense if we were somehow related to a more human-type entity that, rather than something that looks like an anorexic stick insect or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, then it's the thing with them coming great distances. They come all this way, then they crash.
Yeah, actually, I think Mac, more than anybody else, made a very good point about Roswell, you know, possibly being like a crypto-terrestrial homegrown type thing, you know. But when I say homegrown, I mean by some other type of entities from here. You know, the idea he suggested was that maybe it really was a balloon. It was a spy balloon, but it wasn't our spy balloon. You know, we assume that these things are flying around in fantastic craft all the time. Well, what if they're kind of impoverished and some of their craft literally are balloons? Maybe they're made of stuff tougher than ours, but they're not all sort of super fast craft. You know, they've got some things, if they're on a wane and a decline, that, you know, they have to go with what they've got. And perhaps, you know, this was one of the earlier models, you know, and it really was like a balloon-type device, and it went off course and crashed. And,
yeah.
You know, maybe the military did go out, found all this balloon material, thought, well, is this a weather balloon? Is it one of our secret balloon projects? And then came across these weird bodies and realized, well, this is strange. You know, they're unusual bodies, but this is balloon material. You know, and maybe that was a big puzzle that even they couldn't understand for a while. So,
well, you ruffled some feathers also a few years back with your book, Body Snatchers in the Desert. Is that what it was called?
Yeah, that was sort of, again, took an alternative approach to Roswell. You know, the idea that it could have been some sort of high-altitude series of balloon experiments using prisoners of war, Japanese prisoners of war. Now, people said, well, you know, why haven't we heard this story before? But the ironic thing is we actually had. There was probably 7 or 8 people who were exposed to this aspect of the story before. Leonard Stringfield published details in his 1991 status report where he was told that sort of handicapped Japanese people taken from asylums and hospitals were being flown to Los Alamos to take part in radiation experiments in 45 to 47 and high-altitude balloon experiments. Then in 1997, Popular Mechanics said that they'd been told of a forthcoming release of documents that would talk about like a Japanese equivalent of the whole Operation Paperclip thing that would explain Roswell. Now, those files didn't surface, but there are a number of people who've come out with stories very similar from, you know, insider people again. But, you know, I admitted back then and I admit now, we're dealing with such a hall of mirrors that clearly Roswell cannot have been aliens, crypto-terrestrials, Japanese, time travelers, and demons. You know, somewhere we have disinformation. The big question is where that disinformation begins and ends, and which of the theories is the correct one. And I think the mistake so many people in ufology have made is kind of beating the drum of one scenario rather than putting the information out and saying, here's what we've got on this angle, here's what we've got on this angle. Let's see where we can take them further. And if we discard one as, you know, lies or whatever, but the other one seems to be the correct one, even if it's not what we initially thought it was going to be, if that's what it seems to be, then that's probably what it is. You know, and that's one of the big problems with ufology. People stand by theories, come hell or high water.
Mm-hmm.
They should be standing by the data and trying to see where the data goes, not force fit the data into their particular theory. And I actually think that's what the Collins elite did do to an extent. You know, not necessarily deliberately, but sort of putting pieces together because they thought, you know, it was something that agreed with what they believed. And so they, you know, it was logical to them that, well, this is what it has to be. So.
Can I jump in there?
Sure.
Okay, there's one last question I had for you, but there's another one that kind of arose while you were speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just going to ask you this because I would like to know Boucher's feeling about this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I think as far as looking at Scripture and not necessarily doing a revisionist history thing,
mm-hmm.
but really really taking a look at what's written and taking it literally. And it comes
mm-hmm.
down, if you will, to even the use of prepositions.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I wanted to ask you because of what just had been said. I think that Adam led with that because of Mac's work. But, you know, I look in Scripture and it says, in the days of when there were giants in the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of statements about in the earth, into
yeah.
a mountain. And I don't think that that's just a blasé use of a preposition.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now looking at it as, yeah. And I'm not trying to lean on everything being below ground, but I think
mm-hmm.
Christians have to open up their mind to the fact that we're not necessarily surrounded by things we know or can touch or we know the direction
mm-hmm.
from which it's coming. But let me ask you this. You know, I have another Christian brother that I talk to quite a bit. He comes on the show, and
mm-hmm.
we always posit that, you know, Orwell said something about Antarctica, and, you know, Antarctica nobody knows about, but there's a whole lot of people down there doing things.
Mm-hmm.
Just for your personal take, that's what I want to know, Nick, because I respect it. I mean, do you believe that there is something going on and that Antarctica might be a portal and something's going on down there?
Well, I mean, what do you mean with people actually being there, you're on about?
Well, I think that for a place that's supposed to be so barren and we don't hear much about, there's
mm.
a whole lot of countries down there with scientists and other people.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm stretching it a bit, but not that much.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll be honest, I don't know too much about all that. I mean, what I would say, though, you know, is that there are, like, a lot of places on the Earth which, I guess, if there was, like, a crypto-terrestrial race or something was going on underground, you know, when you're talking about in the Earth and things like that, if certain things were set up a long, long time ago before, you know, we were sort of had access to aircraft and satellites, etc., we wouldn't obviously have seen it being built. You know, I think it might be more
right.
difficult in today's world to get away with something like that. But if these are very ancient, you know, caverns or whatever that hollowed out and deep underground, then possibly things could come and go, you
okay.
know, in certain areas. We would never know about it.
And lastly, a specific question, which you spoke to early on, at least the issue,
mm-hmm.
that I'd like to ask you about, because I think Adam will understand where I'm coming from with this as well, because when it comes to what's really happening in the United States, let's just say, although it seems to be happening around the world, we talk about certain kinds of psychotronic, electronic harassment.
Mm.
But you mentioned early on, and it did make me want to ask you about this, since it is
mm.
in the book as well. How do you feel, and are you 100% sure, about the ability to remotely induce trauma to human beings?
I wouldn't say I'm personally 100% sure it can be done. What I can say is that certain people in the Defense Department believe that if it could be done, it was worth researching. Now, what I would say is that there's absolutely no doubt that there have been some very weird deaths. For example, back in England in the 1980s, particularly, but also in the 70s and early part of the 90s, there was a whole spate of deaths of people in the scientific community who were working on some very sensitive projects, many of them linked with the Marconi company. And a book was written about this called Open Verdict. And
mm-hmm.
if you Google Marconi scientist deaths, you'll see an astonishing number of people who, you know, they were going to work one day and then they just drive their car into a gas station and blow themselves up. Or they, one guy, you know, put a rope around his neck and just tied the other end to a lamppost and drove off. Or they just drive to a bridge and jump off. And a lot of them, interestingly enough, were people who were actually nearing the end of their contracts and were thinking of leaving. You know, it's almost, did somebody trigger them
yeah. mm-hmm.
to take themselves out so they'd never be able to sort of be captured by enemy agents or spill the beans to a foreign country? And if you look at that, it also, I don't know if you know these stories in more recent years over here, with all the deaths of people in the microbiology field.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You know, it's almost like people, for whatever reason, are just taking upon themselves to, like, drop like flies off buildings or in car accidents or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to wonder, because there's no evidence that, you know, foul play in many cases, but they just seem to have killed themselves or died. You have to wonder, are we seeing a pattern that is actually fitting
yeah.
this particular program, you know, that somebody is causing it. You know, you could affect somebody's mind to where they just, they're happily listening to the radio or whatever, and then they suddenly get in the car and set themselves on fire or whatever. So who knows?
All right, thanks for taking that question. I appreciate
right,
it,
sure.
Nick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on that uplifting note, Nick, we're going to wrap up this episode. Once again, I mean, it's easy to find your books. Just go to Amazon, punch in Nick Redfern, or go to nickredfern.com. And I highly recommend this book. It might disturb a few folks, but will definitely stretch your brain. Final Events and all of your books. So thanks much for coming on, Nick.
Oh, thanks, guys. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Well, Viz, that wraps up another episode of Transmissions from a Dying Planet. Any parting words?
I tell you what, one of the reasons I think that Nick gets a good deal of respect, and I think the same was with Mac, is that I just find him very taciturn, polite, direct, and I think that's the reason why that happens. And, I mean, I'd be more inclined to talk to them than some others. So I just think that his respect is well deserved, and you know, thank you for having him on.
He's a good dude. Hey, so we'll see you next time in a month or so, eh?
That would be the second Tuesday.
Okay.
Again, don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do. Till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away.